Could we start the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Hi, everybody. My name is Jenny. And I'm a very happy Al-Anon. Before I introduce Bob, who is our next speaker, I would like to just take a few minutes to thank the committee for, I think, a fantastic job that they have done for us. Could I have the committee members please stand so we could give them a round of applause? This is the first time District 21 has done a meeting in mutual cooperation with an alcoholics group, and this time it's been a real experience with us. Yeah. it has really been a good experience, and I thank you all very much for coming tonight and being with us and sharing this fellowship. Several months ago, when we called Bob and Goldeen and asked them to be our speaker, and they said right away that they could make it, it really warmed my heart. Bob doesn't know this, but he was with me when I was first growing up. And what I mean by first growing up is when I first came into Al-Anon, I had a sponsor who really believed in Al-Anon tapes, and she force-fed these tapes to me for a long time. And Bob was one of those first speakers I heard. And his gentleness and his warmth came through that tape and helped me so many ways those first few years I was in Al-Anon. And I have been privileged to meet and to hear Bob speak at other conferences. And it does my heart good to be able to introduce him to you tonight, Bob L. from Riverside.
Hi, my name is Bob Lahan. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And when I first came in here, I saw all those cookies out there. And it made me remember that for 10 years, I thought it was absolutely necessary to eat all those Al-Anon cookies to be a member of Al-Anon. And I found that I can work the Al-Anon program without eating all those cookies, although I've eaten some of them. But it's real nice to be here, and I appreciate the privilege of being up here. Of sharing a little bit, and I'd like to point out Goldeen's story is all hearsay. You know, she was a blackout drinker, so I've been spoon feeding her a little bit about what took place there. But it's real nice to be able to share the other side of it. You know, I was sharing at a meeting the other night, and I said, you know, after the number of years I've been in Al-Anon, probably the word that best describes how I feel, the one single word, is contentment. I believe that that's what the program has given me, is a feeling of contentment. And it's very nice to see AA and Al-Anon cooperate in a joint meeting like this. You know, in Al-Anon, our traditions say we always cooperate with AA, but AA doesn't say that in their traditions. One time I was at a conference, I guess it was down in Amarillo one time, and some way or other I started talking about that tradition, and I pointed out, you know, that Bill Wilson, the founder of AA... This is going on tape, too, isn't it, Fred? I better be careful what I say. You know, the founder of AA, Bill W., helped write the Al-Anon traditions. And he put that in there, and I think he had a little resentment against Lois there, and this was going to be a way to get even with her, making AA, making Al-Anon always contribute with members of AA. But I don't know whether that's true or not. But after that meeting, a man came up and said, is that really true? I thought, oh, my gosh, I got myself in trouble once more here. A number of years ago, we had the privilege of being up at Vancouver, Canada, at a conference up there, and we made a vacation out of it. We took about a week off and toured the islands up there and just had a wonderful time and went in to register at the conference, which is at the Pan Pacific Hotel. It's a five-star hotel. It's this fabulous type of a place and everything. And as I was coming, Goldeen was sitting out in the car. As I came back out, I thought, what did I ever do to deserve this? And then I realized that before the program, I used to say the same thing. What did I ever do to deserve this, you know? And then I got to realize this. that it was a program. And I think I've come to realize that we all are deserving people. And we just don't realize that we are deserving of the goodness that life has to offer us here. And this is a direct result of the program, my understanding of the steps, and the attempt to put those steps into practice in life. But while up there in Vancouver, I went out, Goldie, sitting in the car, went out to her, and I said, you know, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be able to experience things like this. And she said, well, I knew someday you'd appreciate me. You know? I stopped working, I think it was 12 years ago. I did not do that exuberantly. I did not do that the first time the thought came. It took me about 6 months to act on that thought that would never leave me. And this is the way my higher power talks to me. I get this strange, ridiculous type of a thing that I should do something. It doesn't make any sense to me, and it won't leave me. And I realize then that I'm being told something. But anyway, about 12 years ago, I stopped working. I walked away from a business, and I was as scared as Goldine was. And I had to get in touch with myself. And it took a week, and had an old truck with a camper shell on it, and I went camping. And down in Arizona primarily, just to be with myself, to do some writing, do a lot of meditating. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to be around anybody. And one night I ended up in a park down at Tucson. And it was a large park. And I didn't want to be near anybody. And I went clear to the rear of that. And I was probably a quarter of a mile from anybody. And during the middle of the night, I heard a car drive up next to me. And the next morning, I got out and made some coffee for myself. And I looked over in this car, and here was a guy getting up out of the back seat. And he blah, 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 blah. And I thought, my God, I still attract alcoholics. I got to talking to him. He was on a two-week drunk. He had been an Alcoholics Anonymous for maybe 12, 14 years. He had ran a treatment center over in Tucson, but he had that first drink, couldn't stop his drinking. His false pride wouldn't allow him to go back to get some help from Alcoholics Anonymous. He was drinking himself to death, you know. And I left there a little bit before he did, and as I left, I said, I love you. And he started to cry. And see, this is the disease of alcoholism, the inability to give love and to receive love. And I believe that it points out something that I have observed in any 12-step program I've been around, and that is the lack of self-worth that we have when we come in here. Now, a lot of times this lack of self-worth is expressed by groveling and being stepped on, et cetera, et cetera. But there's another type of lack of self-worth which I had, and that's arrogance, the idea of being an achiever. And this was what I was. I was an achiever. I was arrogant. And I would set these goals and I'd reach them thinking that would give me self-worth. And I would reach it and I'd have to set another goal, keep going, going, going. And it wasn't until I came into the program that I finally found self-worth. You know, the idea that maybe I don't have to be this achiever. I don't have to set all those goals, that I don't have to have this thing. Because all of this aggression, et cetera, was a cover-up of what was on the inside of me. So it's through the Al-Anon program I really found myself. I happen to be I believe in the 12 steps. That's the program of recovery. I believe personally that it's the beginning of recovery, not the end of recovery. I happen to believe that the traditions and the concepts are really where recovery is, but it takes 12 steps to get me in that position where I can recover through service and giving of myself. But I believe in the steps, and I've tried to understand them, I've tried to look at them, I've tried to experience them, and I believe that I have discovered, at least for me, that it's not an intellectual process of trying to memorize the steps, because this is what I did. It's not the idea of let me read as much as I can about it, listen to so many people about it. It's a matter of experiencing those things, and it calls for action on my part. But one of the things that is promised in the steps, and it's the only promise I've ever seen it that I can make out of those 12 steps, is in the 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Now, this seems to indicate to me that if I experience those 11 steps, something will happen to me. I have this spiritual awakening. A number of years ago, a woman came up to me and said, you know, Bob, I've been working those first three steps for the last 60 days, and nothing's happening. I said, well, did you ever thought there are 12 of them? I hear a lot of people who work those first three steps every day, and I think they're missing out on something. But I had trouble understanding what that spiritual awakening was. I thought it had something to do with flashes of light burning bushes talking to me. And I climbed a few hills. I was looking for tablets up there, but writing on it. Nothing like that ever happened to me. But several years into the program, I finished some meditating one time, and it's a thought occurred to me that has never left me. And I realized that was my first spiritual awakening in this program. And it was so simple, I almost lost it, except it's never left me. Now, if you listen to me and it goes from my head to your head, you miss the whole point. What I'm talking is my heart to your heart. Because what that thought was, in its simplicity, was that everything's okay. Life is okay. You know, it's my reaction to life that always gets into my trouble. It's my judgment of life that gets me into trouble. I remember a friend of mine. She said I was sitting next to her at her second Al-Anon meeting. I don't remember that. But I kept saying to her, it's okay, it's okay. Now, she had a violent alcoholic husband at home. I kept saying, it's okay, it's okay, okay. She caught that. And she didn't know how to drive a car. She rode a bicycle in meetings. And she said, every time that pedal went on, she said, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, as she went back home. And she walked in the door, and her husband was passed out in the davenport. And she said, it's not okay. She said it took her 3 years to realize that that was okay. See, there was no violence that night. You see? That was the okayness of it. And it's our perception. We put these things in our mind as to what is okay, and we miss the whole point, you see? So in looking back, I have come to realize that every experience in my life is okay. I may not like it. There may be a lot of pain in it, but it's okay, you know? And I've probably gone through as much as anybody in this room has gone through as far as the emotional pain. I think this becomes our common denominator. But in looking back, I find out it's okay. I had a second spiritual awakening years later under the same set of circumstances. And that second one is that every experience is a spiritual experience. There's nothing extraneous. Every experience is a spiritual experience. Everything seems to fit. There's nothing that's not out of that's out of balance here. And I may not understand it, but this becomes my big problem, my big search in life is to see the spirituality of that particular experience. And most recently, by that I mean the last 4 or 5 years, I've come to realize that through experiences, principles are revealed. I was sharing with a woman the other day, she called about this, what her husband had done over the weekend, you know, all that stuff. And I said, isn't it nice that you're married to him? She says, what do you mean? Well, if it wasn't for him, you wouldn't know that you still have anger and you still have intolerance and still have all those things. She didn't like that, but she understood what I said. But I've had a lot of good experiences, and it all came from the fact that I was married to an alcoholic, you see. So I have to come back to the realization and conclusion that I'm grateful I'm married to an alcoholic. Now, I didn't understand what people said when they, early in days, they said they were a grateful member of Al-Anon, you know. I thought that's a bunch of malarkey. But had it not been for me being married to an alcoholic, I probably would never have found this program. So for that reason, I'm very, very, very grateful. I was down at... you see, one other thing about this program is that we hear so much about problems, you know, problems. And I've come to realize that a problem is merely an experience that we projected into the future. That's all a problem is. Come back to the now, there's no problem. I was down in Louisiana, I believe it was, one time when a woman wanted to talk to me about her problems. And I said, well, let's meet tomorrow for breakfast and we'll talk about your problem. And so we met, ordered the breakfast, and she was sitting there with her elbow on the table holding this piece of toast while she was telling me about her problems. And she had the normal experiences of life. And I was listening very, very intently to her, and she got excited about that, naturally, that somebody paid that much attention to her, you know. So she became excited. And then she started this thing called projection. She said, you know, Bob, in 6 months this might happen, and 9 months this might happen. She said, Bob, what should I do? And no hesitation out came, why don't you eat your toast? You see, that's the only thing she had to deal with at that particular time, is what are you going to do at this very moment? And that's what this program is all about, is come on back now, everything's okay. Now, I can prove that, and you can prove that very quickly. When you get a phone call from this person with all the problems, ask them, what were the problems you had last year at this time? Huh? Well, you had as many problems last year as this as now. What were they last year? Well, I don't remember. I said, well, that's what happens with problems, see. They're really not there. Goldine told you about us being married, you know, a little over 50 years ago. One thing she didn't tell was that she came down to Corpus Christi, Texas, when I was still going to cadet training with Naval Aviation, and Navy cadets were not supposed to be married. You couldn't get into the program being married. If you ever married in the program, they found out about it, automatic war shot. But we were having a party one night with another couple who had, on the sly, had gotten married. And we had the bottle of gin. And they thought it was a pretty good idea to get married. And we kind of thought it was a pretty good idea, too. So this other woman worked for a judge in Corpus Christi, Texas. She called him and said that Goldie and I want to get married. So he said that he would get a license the next day at the courthouse to find a minister so we'd get married on Sunday. So we got married. And I had every eighth day off, I believe it was, so after I had to be back that night. I always tell that story to tell you about the power of alcohol and sex. If you put those two things together, anything can happen. And Goldine used to always say that, you know, when she drank, everything seemed like a good idea. You know. But we were a couple of kids. I was not even of age at that time, by the way, in Texas. And I'm going to hold that over her head and sometime get our marriage annulled. You know, I got to... every eighth day, we would do the same thing. We would buy a bottle, we'd go out to a honky-tonk, and we would dance and drink and have a lot of fun. No big deal, you know. We were really living life to its utmost there. And as time went on, every once in a while, she wouldn't be ladylike. And I had to be married to a lady, you know. So I would caution her about this verbally. And as time went on, I would have to use my Al-Anon elbow. And at times I would pinch her to get her attention. A couple times I hit her. And this was all for her benefit, by the way, to make her into this lady, you know. And I believe then by that time, she had crossed that invisible line into alcoholism from social drinking. And I believe that alcohol then gave her enough courage so that she didn't have to mind me. But I think that at that time, then I also crossed an invisible line into Al-Anonism, which I describe as a neurotic compulsion to stop the drinking of a person who has a neurotic compulsion to drink. You know. So this is when I started trying to control her. And I really didn't understand that it was alcoholism. She just wasn't minding me, you see. And so I had to keep putting all this pressure and all the things that we do married to an alcoholic to try to control the life of another human being. We were living in Long Beach, I think, when it came really to the head. And I remember one time that we used to, on a Friday night, always go up to a little a steak place and a cocktail bar up in the corner and kind of relax on a Friday. And it always ended up the same way, that we would eat and go into the bar, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd be fighting and arguing, and the bartender would say, the bar's closing, you know, it's time for you to go home. And next day, I'd look in the billfold, and a lot of the paycheck was gone. And one time, I said, we're not going to do that anymore, because we're always getting so much trouble. And Goldine said, well, let's go up there, have one drink, eat dinner, come home. And that sounded pretty reasonable, you know. So we went up there, had the one martini. Then they brought the Roquefort salad, and I was watching Goldine. It was all over her face, all over her blouse, all over the table. I thought, how on one martini did she do that? And then she said, let's have one after-dinner drink. Well, at 2 o'clock in the morning, we were fighting, and the bartender was saying it's time to go home. And the next day, I thought, how'd that happen? It never occurred to me that she had been drinking all the time that she was getting ready, you know. But it was about that time I found a hidden bottle. My God, you know, we had liquor up in the cabin at times, but she wouldn't drink from that. But this started our little game of playing hide and seek. She's a pretty good hider, a pretty good seeker too. You know, I had a degree by then on how smart I was. You know, hanging up there on the wall, but you could find me crawling around my hands and knees looking for this bottle. One time at a meeting, I mentioned that I found the bottle in the bottom of a 5-pound box of soap. Somebody said, why did you look there? I said, well, there wasn't any other place it could be. But I remember I'd take this bottle and I'd set it up in the kitchen counter and I started asking Al-Anon questions. I'd say, why do you do it? And I kept getting alcoholic answers. I don't know. And I said, you do too know. I said, I don't know. And this would lead us into meaningful discussions. You know. And many times, both of us had to get the last word. You know, in any discussion, we had to get the last word. And if you have two people like that, you know where it's going to end up. But many times I tell her, if you're going to be like that, then get out. Get out. And she'd get in the car and drive around the block, come back, we'd kiss, make up, and live happily ever after. And next month, you know, get out, get out. If she'd gone too long, I'd get in the other car and go try to find her, you know. There were times when I would punish her. I wouldn't speak to her. And we could go 2 or 3 or 4 days without word one spoken. And sometimes she says those are the happiest days of her life. You know. But I guess it was in Long Beach that kind of came to its head, and I ended up being a bottle marker. I don't know whether any bottle markers in the room here. Okay, you understand. Nobody else played the game right, did they, huh? You understand. Yeah. But I ended up being a bottle marker, put it there in the morning, come home at night, put another mark, and then I could tell how much she drank. See, I thought that was my responsibility as a husband, know how much she was drinking, right? After sobriety, I saw Goldine one time pouring this bottle of vodka down the sink, and I said, you know, why are you doing that? We might have guests sometimes. She said, all it is water. And so they can outsmart us all the time, can't they? All the time. But that was when it came to a head. Now, I'm very glad that I can look back at those traumatic times and laugh, you see. And I guess that's one of the balms of, you know, healing is the Al-Anon program is a healing balm. It really is. Because what happened is that this alcoholism destroyed our marriage. There was absolutely nothing left of it after we came into the program, you know. And a couple of years ago, not too long ago, I asked Goldine, I said, did we ever sit down and say, let's see if we can work our marriage out? And she said, no, we never did. What we did, we just kind of hung around, working our respective programs, and a healing took place. And that's what's involved here, is a healing that totally non-understandable. It's a most illogical thing I've ever run into, except that it works, you know. But a healing took place due to this spirituality of this program. We used to drink with this next-door neighbor and his wife. And I used to tell Goldine, I said, don't drink so much, you know. See, I could do that. I didn't have the allergy of the body. I could drink and then maybe not have to finish the drink. We just got by a bottle on a Saturday night party, and I'd say, let's save half of this for next week. And I couldn't understand why Goldine and Frank had to finish that bottle, you know. But one of the nice things about the Al-Anon program is that I do not have to understand why an alcoholic drinks. After 28 years, I don't understand why an alcoholic drinks after he fully knows that he's an alcoholic. I don't understand that at all. Goldine does. I don't, because I'm not an alcoholic. But that's not the Al-Anon program. The Al-Anon program, I don't believe for me, is to give me understanding, because this understanding is an intellectual act, and Al-Anon is not an intellectual program. It's a spiritual program. And I believe then that acceptance is the spiritual act. Now, I wasn't brought up that way. I was brought up, don't accept anything until you understand it. And Al-Anon says, no, 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 accept everything before you understand it. You see? And I've tried to do that, and occasionally then understanding comes. But it's the acceptance that's the most important thing. One of the things that alcoholism did for me is it created tremendous anger within myself. The anger against her and the kids and life and everything, you know. And I discovered later that anger is merely my feeling of insecurity, my feeling of being threatened. That's all anger is, you know, for me. And Al-Anon has corrected that no longer am I this insecure person that I was before. No longer am I this threatened person before, as I was before. And so generally anger has left me. But I would be out dealing with the public. And one of the things that this obsession of the mind of the non-alcoholic is just as strong as the obsession of the alcoholic. My obsession to control her was just as strong as her obsession to drink. And one of the things about an obsession, that it's a mental obsession, and it's not bound by any geographic means, you know. I could be sitting in an interview with people and I get angry thinking about what she did last night or the night before, or my God, is she drinking, where's she at, and all that stuff. And I would completely forget what I was supposed to be doing in that interview. And this is what an obsession is. I could be driving down the freeway and not paying attention to my driving, but again, you know, remember last night, remember. And this is the obsession. It's just as strong in the non-alcoholic as the alcoholic, you know. And I was getting more angry. And I was working for a two-man partnership at the time, and I was about ready to leave that business that I'd been at for quite a while. And one of the partners found out about it and said, where do you want to go? We'll open up an office there. A miracle in my life? No, but apparently absolutely necessary as part of my life. That's how we got out to Riverside. We had about 3 or 4 months of advance notice before moving to Riverside, and Goldine said, "Get off my back, leave me alone. When we get to Riverside, I'll stop the drinking." To this date, I do not remember much about what happened during those 3 or 4 months. I remember everything else. That's why I always say to members of AA who are running conventions, I always give the Al-Anon speaker more time because we remember more. We remember everything. You know. But I came into Al-Anon and I got to thinking, why is it that I don't remember that? And I took a little inventory of that, and the reason for it was this, that I had come from a broken home, and I remember saying to a God I didn't believe in, understand, or know anything about, that praying that our family would get back together again, and that prayer was never answered. This turned me off in this God bit until I came into the Al-Anon program. But something else occurred that was a little bit more subtle, and that is that I was not going to have a marriage like my parents. Now, I don't recall ever consciously thinking that, but it was instilled down there. And it was for this reason that, as far as I know, I never complained about my wife to another human being, because they would know that ours was not this happy marriage. And this is why I carried all that stuff inside of me for 22 years. And I could be in social situations, you know, where I just heat, you know, just disgusted with her and wanted to hit her, and I could put this smile on, making people think that ours was this happy marriage, you know. I could be the perfect gentleman, just when they kill her, you know. But coming back to why don't I remember those 3 or 4 months, I believe this is true, that we have to find a basis for our happiness. And the basis of my happiness was a successful marriage. So regardless of how often she failed me, she would promise, you know, she would promise, break the promise, come back and promise again, back and forth, back and forth. The reason then that I had to always come back and believe her is I had nothing else greater than that to believe in. I believe this is why an alcoholic drinks. The promise that until they replace the basis of their happiness with something else, I'll always go back to that obsession. So that's why I don't remember those 3 or 4 months. But we got out there, Goldine wasn't going to drink, and shortly thereafter she started her drinking again, and nothing changed except the hiding places. After a while, she started going in and out of AA, so I thought maybe I should help her. And I remember the first time in Long Beach when she went to AA, I remember saying one time, "I'm not going to let her be an alcoholic. I'm not going to let her be an alcoholic," you know. And I didn't support her in her AA program because, you know, my concept of an alcoholic was somebody laying in the gutter with a paper bag and a bottle in it. You know, I was not going to let her be an alcoholic. I didn't even know what an alcoholic was, but I was not going to let her be one. But when I started out there in Riverside, I guess I mellowed a little bit and started going to AA meetings, speaker meetings. And I could really identify with that speaker and her. And I'd give her the Al-Anon nudge. And on the way home, I'd go through that speaker's talk with all those important points that she should remember. And she would give me this go-to-hell type of look, you know, and next day she'd be drunk, and I couldn't understand it, you know. Couldn't understand it. Time went on, and she told you about how, I heard nothing about alcoholism. I heard nothing about the first drink, but, you know, put her on as a secretary. And all we got out of that was instead of she being a drunken housewife, she was a drunken secretary. That was the only difference, you know. And sure enough, I brought that bottle of champagne home, you know. What I wanted was have one little drink. I didn't expect her to be drunk for a whole year because of that one drink, you know. But things kept getting worse and worse, and we had the 16-year-old daughter who wasn't minding me. And one night I put pressure on her. I said, "Barb, you start minding me, you're going to have to get out." And the first thing I know, she's packing all the grips. She walked out of the house. And I thought, she'll be back. She needs me. She didn't come back. I thought I'd better go find her. And I found her down by the freeway at a phone booth. And I went up to her. I said, "Barb, you start minding me and you come back." And she looked me right square in the eye. I said, "Dad, I'm not coming back." And I didn't know what to do. See, this is the bad thing about self-righteousness. I could take no responsibility at all. It was just her. You know, I wanted to make her into a young lady, and she didn't want to be a young lady, apparently. And I didn't know how to say sorry. I didn't even know that I was sorry. And I remember I left her there, and I remember driving home and saying, you know, everything that we tried to make of this marriage? It's going down the rat hole. You know, Goldine's drunk every night and daughter running away. Barb, as Goldine mentioned, Barb, when she graduated from high school, we were on the program by then. I was able to sit her down and make amends, verbal amends to her. That's not my real amends didn't come until I became an Alateen sponsor. God made me become an Alateen sponsor. I fought that one like mad. I said, I don't like kids, and kids don't like me, you know. And God kept saying, you know, become an Alateen. So I did, and I learned to love kids. And by golly, a miracle happened. Apparently, kids learned to love me too, you know. But I found that was my real amends, by the way, not just saying I'm sorry to my daughter, you know. But anyway, after a while, there was some violence that started after about 10 years of my daughter's marriage. And one night, she called and said, Dad, can I come home? And I had enough Al-Anon in me to say, I'm sorry, Barb, you can come home for a visit, but you can't come home to live. Because I recognized that she was trying to run once more from alcoholism. As a result of my refusal, we had for many years suggested she try Al-Anon, but no, she didn't need Al-Anon. But as a result of my refusal, she started going to Al-Anon, and she got her self-worth, and she found some spiritual values, see, which she did not have. I personally believe that we cannot run from alcoholism. I see people trying to run from alcoholism. You know, they're married to an alcoholic. I got to get rid of this one, and they turn right around and marry another one. They get rid of that one. Here comes a third one, you know, until they learn the lesson that maybe there's something to, instead of running from something, maybe it's necessary to work through something. And this is what happened to Barb. She worked through some things, and the marriage didn't last, which is okay, you see. But she didn't run from it. She went to something else, you see. There was one night when Goldine did something that hurt the male ego. She was passed out in the bed, and I was standing over trying to figure out what should I do. Should I kill her, kill myself, or kill both of us? And these were valid thoughts. And I was trying to think of some way I might kill her. And I found this to be true for me, that when I have a crazy thought, my higher power gives me something crazier to think about to keep me from doing it. And the reason I didn't is, what would the neighbors think? You know, obviously they would know that ours is not a happy marriage, you know. So another month went by, and again something happened, and this time I kicked her out again, and that's when she went down to Long Beach. And I was left home with two small boys, trying to be the mother and the father and the lunch packer and the house cleaner and all that stuff, feeling absolutely miserable but enjoying it. You know, that's a very deadly combination, you know, self-pity and martyrdom is very deadly, very deadly. But after about a week, Virginia called and said, why don't you come down and see if you can reconcile? So I went down there and I laid out the ground rules. They wrote that pamphlet about me. Some of us are arrogant, smug, self-righteous, domineering. That's why I walked in there. Every time I hear that red, I feel something go off my spine. I don't know what that means, but hopefully I'm not that much anymore. But anyway, that was the night that I was introduced to Al-Anon. In these words, Virginia said, Bob, had you ever thought of Al-Anon? I didn't know what she was talking about. I had never consciously heard the word. But undoubtedly, the word must have been mentioned at one of those AA meetings that I went to. But we hear what we need to hear when we need to hear it, and not before. And I thought it was a method to keep Goldine sober, so I agreed to go. And I went to a newcomers meeting. And I walked in there, and they're all ladies. Not a single man there. And I could tell by looking at them they didn't have my problem. You know, some of them were smiling, and some of them had sparkles in their eyes. And I seemed to indicate I had this wife who wouldn't stop her drinking, and they gave me the answer that I couldn't stop her from drinking, and I knew I could. I just needed the right technique. And apparently Al-Anon was not it, so I was not impressed. But on the way home, Virginia said, Bob, before you make up your mind, try at least 6 meetings. And I said I would. I had made a commitment. I was a people pleaser then. What would Virginia think of me if I didn't go to 6 meetings? So we went back. Goldine was not going to drink anymore. You know, we're going to live happily ever after. And after a short period of time, she started drinking. But I started going to Al-Anon consistently. Why? Well, I think it was early in Al-Anon I came to feel and realize this, that when I went to a meeting, I felt better. And when I went to a meeting, I seemed, the next day seemed to be a little bit better. And I still have that feeling. I remember one night at a discussion meeting, I thought, you know, I could have stayed home in this comfortable Davenport, laying in the Davenport in a comfortable house and et cetera, and have read everything that was said tonight. But I realized, but there was something added by my being in that meeting. And I don't know what it is, but I believe I'm getting to know what is in these meetings. There's something, there's a presence here that I can't find any place else. And I still go to meetings for that. There's something here that sort of indescribable that I can't find anyplace else. One of the things that was a gift that was given to me, and everything I have ever had in Al-Anon has been a gift. I have acquired nothing of my own will. It has been a gift, everything. But one of the things that happened in the second meeting I went to, I met the first man in Al-Anon. And he apparently had not been around very long. I mean, he had not been around there for a while. And people were welcoming him back, and I got there a little bit early, and I was listening to the conversation. And I heard the question, "And how is your wife?" And he says, "Well, you know, she hasn't had a drink for 6 months." And I thought, "Well, what's he doing here? If his wife isn't drinking, why is he here?" And he said the strangest thing. He said that people at work were bugging him. He had to come back to find some serenity. And I thought, what the heck is he talking about? But this is the way the program has dealt me. I hear strange things said by people with smiles on their face and sparkles in their eyes that make absolutely no sense to me. But if I think about it long enough, I have what's called the experience. Oh, I get it. You know, it fits. And if you don't think you've ever had the experience, go back and read your literature and your books again. You'll see it's been revised since the last time you read it. There are brand new thoughts. I was mentioning to a member of AA who's having some relationship problems up, which fits into the Al-Anon program, you know, and he had some 17, 18 years. I said, "Now it's time for you to start reading between the lines of the big book." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you'll get it." starting to read between the lines, you see. So there's great wisdom between the lines of what we read, you see. I still have experiences. One of the biggest experiences I had on the thing, which changed my whole life, was I was probably 7 years into the program going to a step study meeting. And every time we came around that third step, my question always was, how do I turn my life and will over the care of God? I could never get an answer. And after about 7 years, somebody put a new word in there that had never been there before. The word decision. All I have to do is make the decision, and how I do it is not my business, but God's business. All I have to do is make the decision. I hear a lot of people say they take the third step every day. I don't. I reaffirm the decision on a daily basis, but I do not make a new decision. If I make a decision today to turn my life and will over the care of God, and I made the decision yesterday, then apparently I really didn't make the decision yesterday, but I only thought I made it yesterday. So a decision, in my opinion, you make once. So for me, it's the third step I only take once. The rest of them I'm taking working continuously, so I can only make a decision once. You know, like the bird sitting up the fence. I have decided I'm going to jump off the fence. Next day, he's still sitting there. I've decided I'm going to jump off the fence. And the third day, I've decided I'm going to jump off the fence, you know, and he never jumps off the fence. But I found that for me, the way that I turn my life and will over the care of God is through the 11th step, for me. Now, nobody else has to agree with that, but that's the way I work it here. But anyway, I still keep having these experiences. One of the things that happened, I was around Al-Anon about 6 weeks, and I use that word deliberately, around. I think we can be in the program or around the program. If we're around the program, things might happen, they may not happen. But if we are in the program, things will happen. But I was around the program about 6 weeks when I was feeling absolutely miserable. And I realized Al-Anon had made me miserable. The way I like to put it is, when you're miserable and don't know you're miserable, you're not nearly as miserable as when you're miserable and you know you're miserable. And I think that this is really what Al-Anon is for, is to make people aware how miserable they are. A lot of my 12-step work is making people aware how miserable they are. You know, see, and then what are you going to do about it? You know, because this is the solution. You know, people say, "Oh, I'm miserable. This happened." Good, good, good. You know, you don't understand. Yeah, I understand. Good. Well, I was feeling absolutely miserable, and Al-Anon made me that way because they had made me aware of me. They had suddenly taken that finger and turned it around, and that was what was making me miserable. Is I didn't want to look at me. And I went to a meeting that I'd never been to before, as far as I know, and to tell Al-Anon off. And I spent about half that meeting ranting and raving about what they could do with this program, what they could do with Al-Anon. And those ladies just sat there and they smiled at me. And then a woman who had been sent from Seattle, Washington, to change my life, looked me right square in the eye, and she said, Bob, you know now, and you have a choice. You can be miserable or you can work this program. And that was the slap I needed right across the face to get my attention. I believe that was when I took the third step. When I made the decision, I no longer wanted to be miserable. Now, the next morning, there were not great insights or anything like that, but something happened, and that was this. The direction changed. I became teachable. I started to stop the arguing about all of these things. I got over what's called ego sclerosis. I stopped the yes buts and you don't understand and all of those stuff. And I started listening to what you people were saying. And I started then to try to put into practice the suggestions that you made. The other day I asked somebody, I said, what's the difference between suggestion and advice? Same thing, aren't they? Well, anyway. but anyway, I started putting these things into practice to the best of my ability. I came into Al-Anon with one defect of character, an alcoholic wife. But it was surprising how many defects Al-Anon gave me in a very short period of time when I broke through self-righteousness. Sometimes people say, I don't really know what to write down in my inventory. I said, why don't you start with self-righteousness and go from there, you know. But I always like to talk about the first defect of character that I discovered within myself. See, I used to always have this thing called justifiable anger. All my anger was always justified. But I recognized that was a defect of character because afterwards, I would always do these things with my anger. Most of it was verbal, not too much of it physical. And afterwards, I'd say, damn it, Bob, why don't you learn to control your temper? Well, how could I control my temper without being aware that my temper was getting out of control? But I started listening to people talking about letting go, letting God, turn it over, and all of this spiritual thing, you know. But they had the sparkle in their eyes and the smile on their face, you know. One morning, I got up and I said, God, don't let me be angry today. I said that to a God I didn't believe in. And I looked back at the end of the day, I had not been angry. And I remember looking at the incidences within my life, you know, were they different that day? No, everything was the same as the day before, but I was not angry. And I did that for a whole week, and for a whole week I was not angry. And that was a miracle in my life. And that was about 28 years ago, this fall. And from that time until now, I am always made aware of when I am getting angry. See, God never takes away my choice. I still have the choice, but now I'm made aware of it so that I can take appropriate action. And this is what I've discovered for me. I think psychologists and psychiatrists say there's two ways to handle anger. Hold it in, let it out. And Al-Anon taught me a third one, that is to learn to love the thing that makes you angry. That takes a lot of courage, by the way, a lot of trust. It's part of the program. The example I always use involves a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who I detested. I didn't mind telling him what I thought of him. He didn't mind telling me how he thought about me. And we would get into these horrendous discussions, and I would get mad at him, and he'd get mad at me. And whenever I thought of John, I'd get a knot in my stomach, and I want to get a dowel and put pins in it and call it John. And I just didn't care for John. And one time a person said, why don't you pray for John? I said, why should I pray for John? He said, do you like the knot in your stomach? No, I don't like the knot in my stomach. He said, well, you better pray for him. I said, I'll be damned if I will. But finally, the knot became more unbearable in praying for John. So I started saying, God bless that son of a bitch. God bless that son of a bitch. And pretty soon the SOB dropped away. And I could sincerely say, God bless him, God bless him, God bless him. And you know, John started to change. I went up to him one time. I said, John, I sure have to pray a lot for you. And he said, Bob, I have to pray a lot for you too. One of the things that we read at most Al-Anon meetings, the beginning, at least in our meetings down there, is talking about a change of attitude and then talking about spiritual help. Put those two things together, that without spiritual help, I can't change my attitude. That's what this whole program is all about, I believe, changing my attitude with spiritual help. And this is really what happened with John and I. We changed our attitude with spiritual help through asking God to teach us how to love one another, you know. Shortly thereafter, John moved up here to Northern California. Very typical, incidentally, is it not, that when you have an amend to make to somebody, that face is in front of you all the time, you make the amend, and he disappears, and this is what happened to John. But I'd see him at conventions, I'd put my arm around him and say, John, I love you. And he said, Bob, I love you too. Possibly still an SOB to a lot of people, but not to me, and that's the important thing. One of the things
October. A psychologist, I mentioned that story after at a conference one time, a psychologist came and said, Bob, it's all right to be angry as long as you handle it appropriately. I said, yeah, that's right. But isn't it better to have God remove the anger so that you don't have to handle it appropriately? And he walked off with no further discussion. But isn't that true? Isn't it nice? He goes, that's one of our defects. And the seventh step said, God will remove our defects of character, you see. One of the things in October 4 of our One Day at a Time book is a strange thing down at the bottom that when I first read that, I thought, that's the biggest lie ever put in print. And I was about ready to write WSO and tell him to take that lie out of there. Until I realized it's the most profound thing ever put into print regarding human relations. And it says down there that if I work the fourth through the tenth step, the change in me will be reflected in every person who crosses my path. Now, if I understand that correctly, it says, when I change, you change. When I change, the world changes. And I found that true to me, for me. I proved it to myself enough to know that this is the whole essence of this program. Let me point out something. I look out there and I see a lot of beautiful faces. Who creates your beauty? I do. Now, you can help. But the final decision, the final perception, is mine. Is it not? Same way with you, or the person across your breakfast table there. You create the beauty in that person, or you create the ugliness in that person. And that's what this program is talking about. We can create beauty if we want to clean up our own act. And that's the beauty of this program. See, we have control of the beauty in our life. One time wrote a little over 100 years ago, he said that love is the essence and beauty is the manifestation. Love is the force, beauty is the result. So through this program, we can cause as much beauty as we want in this life, you know. But I from that experience, I came to realize that God, this God I did not understand, was doing something in my life, and I didn't know what it was. Now, during this period of time, I was still going to Al-Anon meetings, and I was had memorized the steps. I could tell a person they were powerless over alcohol. And I'd leave that meeting, and I'd wonder, I wonder if Goldine's been drinking, how much she's been drinking. I'd go home, get down on my hands and knees, find the bottle, put another mark there, all the time thinking I was working the Al-Anon program. For me, I found this to be true. When that, for me, God sets up experiences in my life to walk through so that I can learn the step. It's only after I've experienced this can I go back then and, quote, work the step. But one guy did, one time, we had this place down in Ensenada, and we went down there. Goldie had not had anything to drink for a couple of weeks. And we went down there, went over to some friend's house, and the first thing they did is they poured a drink for her and a drink for me. And up until that time, I would have said, I'm sorry, she's not drinking, thank you. Or maybe I would have drank it myself, but I would have protected her from that alcohol. I was not thinking about Al-Anon. I was not thinking about the first step. But something with a capital S made me aware that that was her choice and not mine. And I sat back to see what took place. Almost like I was a spectator at a sporting event watching two teams play, not caring who won, but interested in the play. And I watched her struggle. I could see this on her forehead. And finally she reached over and she picked up that drink and she drank it. At that instant, something started down here in the pit of my stomach, went out the top of my head. I can still almost feel it. Went, phew. And I didn't know what it was for a couple of months. And I realized that was when I took the first step, or better, when the first step was given to me. When my obsession to try to control her drinking was taken from me and I had never returned. I could allow her then the right to drink herself to death if this is what she thought she should do. That was her decision. I remember one time the bottle came out. She was sitting at the kitchen table drinking from the vodka bottle. And I thought, if she wants to drink herself to death, that's her choice. That's her choice. By this time, there was nothing left of the marriage. I hated her. I loathed her. Somebody said, release with love. No way. I wouldn't even know what it was, you know. I had to release with rejection and hate and all of this stuff. There was one night when Al-Anon taught me it took two to have an argument. If I kept my mouth shut, there wouldn't be an argument. Sometimes I had to bite down on my lips. You know, it draws a lot of blood, but it worked. You know. But one night I was reading the Al-Anon book, and she wanted to have an argument. She was standing there, yak, 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 and I wanted to hit her and backhand her, and the little voice said, read your book, and all it was a mass of black print, and And finally she let up and she went down into the bedroom. And pretty soon she came back out, and as she went by me, she says, "At least I'm going to die beautiful." And I looked over there. There she was in a negligee. She went out into the kitchen, and I heard her messing around in the medicine cabinet. I thought, "My God, she's going to take some pills. She's going to kill herself." A little voice said, "Read your book, read your book, read your book." And she went back down to the bedroom, and all these thoughts, brrr, you know, about her dying and everything. And finally, a thought came and lodged. I'll give you something to think about. We do not think the thought. We only think about the thought. Here comes one, and it lodged. And I remember the old home remedy, and I got a glass of water, and I got a bar of soap, and I soaked it up real good, and I got a bucket, and I went down to the bedroom, and she was passed out. And I propped her up, and I poured this glass of soapy water down her throat, put my two fingers in her throat and her head in the bucket. Every time my fingers came out, she said, Bob, I didn't take anything, I didn't take anything. That was the last time she ever threatened suicide. Another month or so went by, and I was at an Al-Anon meeting complaining about this drunken secretary. And a wise Al-Anon said, if she was other than your wife, would you keep her? I said, of course not. End of conversation. But not the end of the thought. The thought is, why do we treat relatives differently than people? If she had been other than my wife, I would have fired her in a second for being drunk on the job like that all the time. And then I sat her down that one time. I said, I don't care whether you drink, but not in the house. If you're going to drink, you're going to have to get out. And I fired her. Several days went by before I realized she had stopped her drinking. And I should say she had 28 years in September. What happened spiritually? This is not an intellectual program. It is not a psychological program. It's not a behavior modification program. It's not a tit-for-tat program. It's not if I do this, I get that kind of response. It's a spiritual program dealing with spiritual energy. And I think it was the same principle as I had down in Mexico when my obsession with her was removed, is that I had backed off physically, emotionally, and mentally to allow a power to come into the situation to create some good, which at that time was to relieve me of my obsession. This other than something I backed off physically, emotionally, and mentally, and again, something came in and sobriety came. I believe that the thing called release or detachment is the same thing that alcoholics call surrender. I think it's the same principle. It's just to give up. The words I used when I told her to that she was going to get out of the house if she kept drinking were probably pretty much the same as I had used many times before, except this time my motive was different. I was not in any manner trying to control her drinking. I didn't care what she drank, not in the house. Years later, Goldine said, you know, that was half my house that you were kicking me out of. I said, yeah, but God wouldn't let you know, would he, at the time. But I think something else happened that I was willing to let the relatives, friends, and neighbors know ours was not a successful marriage. Spiritual pride. I was willing to walk through that. But most important was this understanding for me presently, that I had changed my priorities for the basis of my happiness. No longer was the marriage the number one priority. That some way or other my emotional comfortableness, my relationship with God, was the primary my priority. And my understanding of this came when I read the Bible a couple of years later from cover to cover, and I don't understand 99.9% of it, but I ran across the story of Abraham and his oldest son, the apple of his eye. God said, sacrifice your oldest son for me. And Abraham became willing to do so, and because of his willingness to do so, he did not have to do so. I read that and said that was key. I had become willing to give up the marriage, which was an inside transformation. Now, the AA Big Book says the same thing. Become willing to go to any lengths for sobriety, and I'm sure the word sobriety is a greater connotation than just drinking. It doesn't say you have to go to those experiences. It says you have to become willing to go to those experiences. You see? And I read that was the key, you see. So, my priorities to our marriage changed. The important thing, the number one priority, is my relationship with God, which I define as this, my emotional comfortableness. When I'm emotionally comfortable, I'm in what I call a state of love. Defects of character for me are absence of love. And I can get rid of a defect of character temporarily and sometimes permanently merely by bringing in love. You see, guilt is merely non-love of self, resentment, non-love of you, self-pity, and depression is non-love of God. So when I start loving those things, those other defects disappear. You see? So this is my number one priority. Now, how do I get that? I get it from the Al-Anon program. So then I know then that Al-Anon has got to be my number one priority. And this is why Al-Anon comes first in my life, before the marriage, before anything else, because it gives me all those other things. I've tried to be as active in Goldine in service, and I find that the rewards of that are... Sometimes I'd like maybe talk about service. I don't have time tonight. But one of the things I have found is that service reveals all my defects of character. My prejudices, my insecurity, my feelings of inadequacy, my fears, my resentments, my self-pity. All of those are revealed, but it also gives me an opportunity to get rid of them all, too. But we were going to live happily ever after, and I want to touch a little briefly upon one of the things that happened. I don't know when this came, but I remember that I had this feeling of towards Goldine, of hate and stuff like that, and I recognized I was the one with the knot in the stomach. So I took a very simple seventh step, and I didn't know that it was a seventh step, and I said, God, teach me to love her as she is, and she started to change. She's a very, very beautiful person in my life. You see, I was the one that was hurting with the resentment, and she's become a very, very beautiful person in my life that I try not to run. I don't try to run her life too much anymore, but a very, very beautiful person. You know, we have, in February, it'll be 28 years since we had an argument. Some people say, how dull that must be. It's very nice. But, I mean, I'm not trying to say we always agree. We don't have to argue about it, you see. We can go sometimes our separate ways. She may like to, she likes to sew. I don't like to sew. So I do something else. One time, we had a beautiful, beautiful weekend. I was up in the mountains backpacking. She was home sewing, you see. But before the program, we always had to be like that, with one of us maybe not enjoying it at all and hating the other person. For instance, going shopping. My gosh, you just have to go shopping with her, and I don't understand the concept of shopping, you know. I thought it had something to do with buying. It doesn't, you know. So I can allow her to go shopping, and I don't have to go shopping, you know. But then Steve comes along. He was 5 years of age when sobriety came into the household. At about 11 years of age, he got into Alateen. Knowledge of alcoholism, of the big book, and et cetera, is no preventive for alcoholism. About 15 or 16, he started his drinking. At that time, he became a pass-out drinker. And I might have been to a meeting or maybe at a... maybe working or something like that. I'd come home at night, and Goldine would say, "Look at your son," and he would pass out. You know, arms outstretched, eyes open, eyeballs up the top. You see the whites of his eyes. He lay there looking like he was dead. And this went on for a little while. And I would grit my teeth, I'd clench my fist, and start giving him that same thing I used to say to Goldine, until I finally, "Get Bob, get back on your program, get on your program," and I'd let it go. And then there was one time. When I was taking a class in metaphysics, talking about the power of the mind, if I can put this thought in, lock it in, things will be created, according to my thought. And I had to prove that. Steve had not had anything to drink for several weeks, but he was absolutely miserable. That's not taking an inventory, that's simple observation, right? He was miserable. And I knew by then I did not have the right to pray for his sobriety. That was his business. But I felt I had the right to pray for his peace of mind, which is a relationship with God. So at this metaphysics class, I used Steve as a subject to prove this thing of the power of thought. And I wrote this thing out about Steve, and I read it, and I read it, and I read it, and finally it locked into my mind, and I knew that prayer was answered. I went home that night, he was all bombed out, and I couldn't understand that. Because I knew my prayer had been answered, and I woke up the next morning laughing, because I realized Steve was at peace. So we want to be careful what we pray for, you know. I had one more experience, and as I was walking out of the bedroom, I said, "God, I don't understand." I opened up a book I had not looked at for over a year, opened it random, and in general it said, "Now that you messed everything up, why don't you let me do it?" I said, "Okay, God, he's yours." Had another experience with Steve. He was bombed out. I went into the bedroom. I sat down on the edge of the bed, and I took his hand. I said, "Steve, how are you doing?" Because I had a great realization. I was probably 14, 15 years in the program by then. The realization I had was that Steve suffered from a disease called alcoholism. I had never thought of Goldine as suffering from a disease called alcoholism. My experience with Goldine taught me I was powerless over alcohol. My experience with Steve taught me that alcoholism is an illness, a deadly illness. So from that point, his drinking never bothered me. Sometimes his behavior did, but his drinking never bothered me. And I was then able to let him go and let Goldine handle it. And instead of causing what we call triangles, I would allow her the relationship and I would back her up in anything. So that there was no triangle. Because maybe our viewpoint as to how to handle Steve would differ. And lots of times I see this happen in families where they differ and the first thing you know they're fighting among themselves and great destruction. So I backed up Goldie in whatever she wanted to do. And finally, Steve had, you know, he wrecked a couple of cars. He was in jail. He sentenced to AA and all of those things that an alcoholic does. And one time on Christmas Eve, he rolled the car and Goldine was going to have the family in for Christmas, and this devastated her. She told Steve, if you drink again, you're going to have to leave the house. So about 6 months later, he decided he was not an alcoholic. He started his drinking again. So Goldine asked him to leave, and I backed her up, and he left. He went down to Long Beach. And he got into all kinds of trouble, and after a couple of years, he disappeared for 2.5 years. And then, in taking an inventory one time, I thought, is he dead or is he alive? Because we didn't hear from him. And I felt I had a right to know, is he dead or is he alive? And I said a little prayer to my higher power and God, and I said, God, let me know, is he dead or is he alive? Had not heard word one for 2.5 years. 2 weeks after that prayer, a letter comes in from him, and he'd come back to California. Down at the bottom, he says, I'm alive and well. You see? Prayer works. And then he came back into our life, and one time he came out the house, and I said, he'd come out, I put my arm around him, said, Steve, I love you. And one time he stood back, he said, you know, Dad, he says, you may not know it, but I love you too. And this first time I'd ever heard him say that to me, you know. As a father, all of my kids at some time or other said, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, you know. And I realized how uncomfortable they are with the hatred. So I can allow them the right to have those feelings, knowing that ultimately they have to overcome it. But then a couple of more years went by, and it was about 5.5 years ago, we got this call from the doctor. And it was over the phone that I asked the doctor. I said, Doctor, is it AIDS? And he says, yeah, it's AIDS. So Goldie and I cried all the way down to Torrance and went in there. And he was my same height, and he was down to about 110 pounds, nothing but skin and bones and tubes running in and out of him. And he was gay. And we'd never talked to him, or I had never talked to him about it, but I said, Steve, I don't understand it, but that doesn't keep me from loving you, you know. And it brought the whole family together, and this kind of perked Steve up, and he got off of intensive care, and then he got through a lot of medication, and then his kidneys failed. And he was not expected to live for more than a couple of days. But he didn't want to die. He didn't want any life support. He was ready to die. He didn't want to die in the hospital, so he brought him home to die. And he started getting better, and he lived for a year and a half. During that time, they gave us the opportunity to clean up the wreckage of the past with Steve, you know. I remember one of the things I used to do is I used to drive Steve around, you know. Not because I had to, but because I wanted to. I remember one time Steve, he never complained about his own condition. He never complained about the consequences of any of his acts. He always took it like a man, not as a man, right? He never complained about the consequences. But he would talk about society. How come society is not doing this and this for other AIDS patients and things like that? And I realized Steve was complaining. What I do is throw him Al-Anon tidbits. And I came to realize he just wanted to be uncomfortable. Did you know people have the right to be unhappy? We should respect their right. So I started respecting his right to be to complain. And then I realized that I was judging him. So I said a simple little prayer to my higher power. I said, God, teach me to love him as he is. And he stopped complaining. See, my judgment of him was that he was a complainer, which was non-love, you see. So he stopped his complaining. We had the privilege of going to the International in Seattle. And we had Steve fly up afterwards. We met him up at Seattle. And we had a nice, comfortable drive coming back down the coast. By that time, he had gotten an eye infection associated with AIDS, and he started losing his eyesight. And I think Steve made the decision not to live. And when he started going blind, I think he decided that he no longer wanted to live. And so he started deteriorating. And we were with him at the time he died. I was holding on to one hand, Goldine was the other. And just before he died, I said, Steve, I love you. Have a good trip. And he was gone. And then Goldine and I cried. We had all this advanced knowledge about his death. We had all this knowledge about life after death. We had all of this knowledge, you know. Doesn't do a bit of good. We had to go through the grief process and the sorrow process, the crying and things like that, you know, which is the human emotion here. We had a woman in the program do the memorial service for him, a minister, who knew Steve. And she was crying before the service. And I went up and I put my arm around her and said, you know, it's okay, it's okay. She says, Bob, I'm supposed to do that to you. And then I realized the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. It is better to console than to be consoled. And I said, you know, this program works, doesn't it? God kept us busy. God got us busy right after that. You know, it was quite surprising how we were able to carry this message. The following Wednesday, that on a Friday, the following Wednesday, I was speaking up in Van Nuys, and I mentioned Steve's death from AIDS, and a man in the audience came up and said, you know, Bob, he said, my son died about 30 days ago from AIDS, and I haven't been able to talk to anybody about it. So now I find that audiences that, you know, there are people in the audience that have gone through this experience. So everything that I have gone through, any experience I've gone through is shareable, you see. And this is what Goldine is talking about, an open book. We're open books for our experience. To kind of close with a little happier thought, a couple of years after Goldine's sobriety, I was taking her inventory. And I don't take inventories anymore. I make loving observation. But I realized she had never made amends to me. And I thought, how could she be comfortable? How could she be sober? Because in Al-Anon, we always talk about the alcoholic being number one, two, or three. And I thought, you know, Bob, you know, let her work her program. You work your own program. So I let her go. A couple more years went by, and I walked into the kitchen one time, and she was reading the AA Grapevine magazine. And as I went by her, she said, Bob, have I ever made amends to you? And I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. And I realized how long it's going to take, and I said, now get comfortable. Don't interrupt, because this is important. And I took a wide stance, folded my arms, backed up against the kitchen counter. I said, no, you never have. And she says, well, I'm sorry. And she went back reading her magazine. The point of it is this. What right do I have to expect anybody to make amends to me? If I'm expecting somebody to make amends to me, am I not holding on to a resentment? So my job is to make the amends, to clean up the wreckage of the past, rather than to expect the amends, you see. And if we come back down to the program, I think, at least I see, the whole program is one of making amends. And that's to change myself from the monster that I was into something that might be usable. See, the third step said, turn my life and will over the care of God. What did I have to offer at that point? Nothing. But maybe by doing some work on that fourth through the tenth step, maybe through the 11th and 12th step, then we might be usable in some manner. I discovered for me within the last year or so, I'd always been looking for purpose in life. What's my purpose in life? Why am I here? You know, it's not just to be a father and a businessman and all that. What is my real purpose? And I saw it so clearly written in the 12th step. Tried to carry this message. Tried to practice these principles. What greater purpose in life than that? Nothing great big, except it is big, you know. I was sharing with somebody at one time, I said, you know, you're important, but not that important. You know? He took it wrong, got a big resentment against me, but but nevertheless, that's right. Each one of us is important. Each one of us is important, you know, to life, to try to carry this message. So I appreciate being here. Thank you, and love you much.